You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Beware that child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed last week's episode with Dr. Darsha Narvaez. If you haven't heard it, I highly recommend you go back and listen to it. I received positive feedback from listeners, shocked at just how far civilization has strayed from meeting the absolutely basic biological needs of its children. Next week, I talk with movement specialist Hazel Boot on natural human movement. And no, we won't be talking about getting in 100 squats a day. We talk about practices that are significant in terms of the positive effect they have on the body, while at the same time take very little extra effort and time to incorporate into regular practice. In today's episode with Arthur Haynes, we talk about the widespread physical degeneration of civilized society brought about by our domesticated diet. When I first thought of creating this podcast, Arthur is the very first person I thought of for a guest, not only for what we discuss in today's episode, but because he probably already knows all of the content for every episode I'll be bringing out in this podcast. Arthur's vast knowledge of plants, primitive ancestral skills, and hunter-gatherer societies make him the ideal friend to have around when the apocalypse hits. If I have even 10% of his wisdom when civilization collapses, my chances of survival will be pretty high. Forty-eight-year-old Arthur Haynes lives in the Wilder Waters community in Maine with his wife Sarah and five-year-old Samara and one other community member. Arthur Haynes is a forager, ancestral skills mentor, author, public speaker, and botanical researcher. He grew up in the Western Mountains of Maine, a rural area that was home to swift streams known for their trout fishing. He spent most of his childhood in the Sandy River Valley hiking, trekking, and foraging. Arthur now runs the Delta Institute of Natural History in Canton, Maine, where he teaches human ecology, focusing on the values of foraging, wildcrafting medicine, and primitive living skills. A major focus of the Delta Institute of Natural History is developing self-reliance that promotes awareness and eco-conscientiousness. Arthur continues to spend a great deal of his free time practicing his skills as a modern hunter-gatherer. As a research botanist for the New England Wildflower Society, he recently completed a comprehensive flora of the New England region and has authored over 20 publications in peer-reviewed journals and books, including naming species of plants new to science. His series of YouTube videos has inspired thousands of people interested in foraging wild edible and medicinal plants. Last year, Arthur performed an eye-opening TEDx talk in Hartford, Connecticut, entitled What's Wrong with Our Conservation Paradigm? Most recently, Arthur completed his hunting and recreational guide exams, which covered a wide range of topics such as orienteering, wilderness medicine, hunting laws and equipment, and catastrophic event scenarios. Arthur passed these rigorous examinations, and he is now officially a registered Maine guide. Arthur firmly believes that we are at an important crossroads in our existence, one where domestication of the human species has led to an inability for most to nourish, heal, and care for themselves. This process has created profound blindness to the consequences of modern industry and the illnesses associated with nature disconnection. Last night, he had about 10 or 11 hours of sleep. And for lunch today, he had wild-caught pollock from the waters of Maine and stinging nettle greens that they collected from a nearby river with a nice raw grass-fed butter. Arthur, welcome to the show.
Hi, Emily. Thanks for inviting me.
For a long time, I had only ever heard your voice through listening to podcasts, and it sounds very similar to the voice of an oncologist I know from New York. So it was very hard for me to associate the voice of such a well-spoken, civilized person with the reality of your own primal lifestyle. It wasn't until I watched your TEDx talk that I was finally able to connect your civilized voice with your hardy exterior. And to be honest, I think that's probably a big reason I wanted to have you on the show, to help shatter the stereotype that this alternative living is people spending their days, I don't know, hugging trees and sending out positive mental vibes. When someone is highly educated and articulated as you begins to assert the science, it makes people sit up and pay attention. So I wondered if we could begin by you giving a brief description of taxonomy and botany and your work in those fields.
Yeah, thanks, Emily. I do try to marry a couple of different fields, and obviously that is what science has told us in modern times. That's really important because we have a lot of study to rely on. But it's also important to remember that a lot of science takes a reductionist view where it tries to isolate various factors and examine their effects on people's health or landscape health. And the reality is these factors aren't isolated, but they work together in complementary and sometimes synergistic ways with other things. And so we also need to examine the whole. And for me, I really like using observations of ancestral people, hunter-gatherers who were alive during the times when anthropologists, physicians, surgeons, and other people were there to observe them and how they went about accomplishing their daily living, what they ate, what they experienced, if any illnesses, chronic diseases, and so on. And I really think marrying these ancestral observations, or these, I should say, these observations of ancestral people with modern science produces a really strong lens, a really powerful lens to look at health and what humans might need to actually connect with the world, to feel vibrant, to feel healthy, and actually, in all hopes, avoid some of the chronic diseases that have become common today. I'm really happy that, you know, I do have a science background, and it's primarily, it comes from botany, which is the study of plants. I'm a botanical researcher, and more specifically, I work as a taxonomist. And taxonomy can sound very boring, you know, the classification and naming of plants is one definition that it could be given, but the reality is it's the study of the diversity of plants. Much of what we do is to examine the structures that plants produce in close detail and get a chance to explore these organisms in a way that most people don't. And it's really amazing. A lot of my work, because I do focus on the identification of plants, I get to eliminate some of the obstacles that people have when they are trying to learn about foraging and wildcrafting medicine, because we learn next to nothing about plant identification in our public school systems. And so by having that obstacle removed, by being able to apply a name, in most cases quite confidently, to the individual organisms that I see on the landscape, it gives me a really nice place to study from, because now we have an ability to research in the absence of plant elders. We have to often turn to books, reports, journal articles, videos, and things of that nature. And I've been doing that for a long while, and now I get to pass that on to my students, which is really wonderful to allow them a chance to connect with plants in a way that it took me a long time to do. Again, without a lot of plant knowledgeable elders, we're really lacking those in our modern civilization.
Before I came across your work, I thought I ate a very healthy diet, very little processed food, a moderate amount of meat, predominantly that we or our friends have farmed free range, and a lot of fresh fruit and vegetables, some that we have grown or foraged, but mostly from the grocery store. However, the more I have learnt, the more I understand this enormously widespread misconception of the nutrients in modern day foods. And with regards to plant foods, that bigger, brighter and tastier does not actually equal healthier. And I wondered if, as a taxonomist, you could explain what changes in an organism when it becomes domesticated.
Yeah, I mean, that's the unfortunate thing, is we do have a lot of really amazing and very delicious produce that we have access to in the civilized world. But unfortunately, one of the sad facts is it's almost all been genetically modified, primarily through breeding, to produce plants that are not found in the wild. In other words, these are changed organisms that humans have created. And humans seek out things like a greater abundance of food to be produced. So we like bigger things. And we don't like bitters, even though they have a myriad of health benefits for us. And we like sweetness. So we remove bitter compounds from different species and try to essentially produce more of the sweet tasting, juicy types of things that, we really, our palates have become accustomed to. And in the end, we've created foods that, tend to be much lower in nutrition, in some cases profoundly so. And all of this lack of nutrition as we're, you know, eating these cultivated foods on a daily basis makes it really hard for us to reach the levels of nutrition that our hunter-gatherer ancestors had. And there's a lot of examples and there's a lot of reasons why. You know, for example, and I'll give just a few brief ones, plants produce compounds that we call phytochemicals that they use to defend themselves from pathogens and insect herbivores and other things that would obviously affect their health. And these phytochemicals that they produce are the kinds of things that we need plants to actually experience stress for them to produce them. So as soon as we coddle the plants, as soon as we protect them from insect herbivores, they don't have to produce the same levels of defensive phytochemicals. And many of those are really beneficial to our health. So the foods that we tend to eat lack as much of this chemistry as we could find in the wild. And this chemistry has functions like anti-inflammatory, bolstering our immune system, prevention, and even treatment of cancer, and so on and so forth. We also see that we like to make really big things, you know, so cultivated blueberries are really large compared to wild blueberries. And unfortunately, when you have most of the plant pigments that produce antioxidant actions within our body located in the skins, the bigger the fruit gets, the less skin you have in a mass of blueberries. And so we actually lose out on all of these antioxidants. And I don't mean to say that there still aren't some in the cultivated blueberries, because there are, but there are many more in terms of the total amount of ORAC ability, that ability to function as an antioxidant found in the wild species. And another example of this nutrition is that we also know that as we make plants, as we generate these cultivated forms to produce more and more of the food that we're looking to get, whether these are fruits or leaves or underground storage organs, there's something called the dilution effect, where the mineral content of that food part of the plant becomes reduced. And when we look at the mineral nutrition, whether we're talking about calcium or we're talking about iron, I have many examples that I found in the literature where wild plants have three times or sometimes, you know, 20 times as much of these minerals as do the foods that we eat on a regular basis. And when we're just constantly eating foods that lack the nutrition of our ancestral diets, in other words, the diets that our bodies are expecting, you know, our DNA is very similar to the DNA of hunter-gatherers who existed in some cases, you know, 10 or 20, 30,000 years ago. And there's an expectation that we're going to receive this nutrition in our diet. And unfortunately, that expectation is not met. And what we end up seeing are health changes in, you know, form, whether that's bone density or craniofacial form. And we see a lot of this that we find in modern humans, much of which can be, you know, attributed directly to the nutrient-poor diets we eat today.
So you mentioned the bitterness. So I had always been under the belief that any bitterness in foods is nature's way of warning us not to eat that. But that's not true?
No, not really. I mean, we might say that that is true of extreme bitterness, because that could certainly be described as a deterrent to eating it, a red flag that we've developed over many, many, many thousands of years of interaction with plants as food. We, you know, humans and plants have a very strong connection that we've developed over all of the time of, you know, consuming and tending each other. But mild bitterness in no way should be treated in that way. In fact, it has been hypothesized that our bitter taste bud is one of the ways that we detect antioxidants in our food, because some antioxidants do in fact impart a bitter taste to the plants. And when you realize that bitter might be associated with detecting antioxidants in our food, and then you think about our modern diets and how few bitters are found in it. I mean, we have maybe coffee and some dark chocolate, but not much else that people might be regularly consuming. And it makes you realize how much we might be missing out on in a diet that is bereft of bitters.
And I've heard you talk in the past about the grapes and grape seeds. Could you talk some more about that?
Well, that's another great example of the nutrition that has been essentially bred out of our modern produce. You know, This is a case where we took the medicine completely out of the plants, because we know that grapeseed extract, which you can find in a natural food store as a supplemental form, has just a large number of benefits for humans regarding their health. And there's a lot of evidence-based research demonstrating this, you know, benefiting blood vessels, dealing with oral pathogens, protecting the body from radiation, which also includes, you know, the UVA rays that come from the sun, and so on and so forth. The really wonderful thing about grape seeds is that you can get these in wild plants because the seeds are still there. But we've simply bred them out of modern produce because people didn't like to eat them based on texture or based on, you know, they're not quite as sweet as the, you know, the flesh of the grape. And we've just removed the medicine completely out of this food. And it's a sad commentary that we continue to do this. We continue to breed medicine out of food, and then we have to go buy that medicine, sometimes in the form of synthetic drugs from doctors who prescribe, you know, a prescription so that we go to the pharmacist to pick up this drug that stands in for the missing medicine that used to be in our food.
And something like lettuce, which is frequently used as an ultimate leafy green vegetable. Could you give more insight into the true nutritional value of lettuce?
Well, yeah, and obviously it does depend on whether we're speaking about, you know, iceberg lettuce, which is really derived and far removed from its wild progenitor, or if we're talking about, you know, cultivars like romaine and leaf lettuce, which are not as fully removed from the wild progenitor. But in any case, we know that their mineral nutrition, we know that their carotenoids, their provitamin A content is very, very different between these two. And not only do we have vitamin and mineral differences, but we also, again, coming back to those phytochemicals, we have differences in their medicine that they contain. I mean, when we look at the kinds of compounds that are found in high enough amounts in wild lettuce species, which do occur, you know, in Europe, they occur here in North America, we have things that are used as mild sedatives to help people relax and have good sleep and avoid stress. We have things that work in an ability to stop spasm, so that we have, you know, an ability to calm pain associated with certain ailments. And when we look at lettuces that we would purchase in the store, no one would think that in the ingestion of these plants would they be actually taking in medicine that is in fact found in the wild, you know, the wild forms of lettuce, because again, it was a bitter compound. They're terpenes, which tend to present a bitter flavor in many cases, and we've simply bred them out. And when we do that, again, we lose out on some of the values that wild foods provide to humans.
Could you give then some examples of widely used plant foods that have not had so many nutrients bred out of them?
Yes, and I like to think of these with the term minimally modified plant foods. And by minimally modified, I'm just referring to things that haven't been changed to such an extent that there's still some value to consuming them. Not only do they provide us with some nutrition, but they also have some of their medicine intact. And really, there's an easy way for people to learn how to do this. I look for plants that still look like their wild progenitors. A great example is the raspberry. If you take a cultivated raspberry, it's about the same size and looks very similar to the wild raspberry that we can find growing on many continents. So that's a first place to look. I'm looking for often what are stronger flavors. So you take mustards or onions. These are things that still have some of that spiciness, that phytochemistry is still present. And that's a good indication that they're going to present us with plant medicine that can, you know, help prevent chronic disease later in life. I also like to look for plants that could still naturalize from the cultivated setting to the wild landscape. And while I'm not claiming this is always a good thing for all landscapes, but plants that can escape the cultivated setting and can live outside of human tending show that they still have some of their wildness. In other words, they haven't been changed so much that they now require human cultivation in order to survive. And that's also another nice example that it hasn't been modified too much from its wild progenitor. So these are some of the things that I look for in cultivated plant foods to let me know that I'm eating something that's a lot like the wild progenitor, that I'm getting the maximum amount of nutrition from the plants that I can. Spice plants are a great place to start, whether we're talking about onion family, mustard family, mint family. These are all great places because humans liked that spiciness, so they didn't mess around, so to speak, with their phytochemistry. They left it mostly intact. And again, size of fruits. I'm looking for things that aren't too large and sort of grossly distorted. I mean, you just don't find things like cultivated watermelons on the northeastern landscape. You know, those kind of foods don't exist. So I'm tending to go for those smaller fruits that I could find in the farmers markets when we're buying plant foods, like ground cherries or what are sometimes called golden berries. This is just a great example of something that is almost exactly like its wild progenitor and gives us a lot of the benefits of the wild.
Would these be some examples of highly nutritious plants that you would recommend anyone with a backyard garden to grow?
Oh, for sure. That's just a wonderful way to make a connection to these plants and also spend more time outdoors. So, you know, blueberries that are not cultivars that are, you know, maximum size, blackberries, raspberries, spicy greens, strong tasting greens, things like rather than growing broccoli and cauliflower, grow kale for its greens because kale still kind of looks like a normal plant. It's, again, not as derived from its wild progenitor. Those are all great things to be able to plant in your backyard. And a lot of times, you know, the things that we're planting that are minimally modified tend to be perennials and much less annuals, although there's lots of exceptions to that. But perennial culture certainly has its value, and a lot of those are not as modified from their ancestral form.
So that would be something like asparagus?
Yeah, that's a great example. Asparagus here, if you were to, travel around the landscape in New England, you can see that it has really no problem escaping cultivation, survives quite well in open areas growing completely wild, and it's one of the perfect examples of those minimally modified plant foods.
So to change it up a bit here, I just recently finished reading From Cover to Cover, which is a feat of stamina given the density of the content, Weston Price's Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. I wondered if you could offer some insight for our listeners to the basic premise surrounding his observations, particularly with focus on what he called prenatal injury in the practice in indigenous societies of preparing both the mother and the father's bodies for conception.
Yeah, Weston Price did us a real favor. And I feel like his greatest accomplishment was not the production of the book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, which is a powerhouse of information. And like you said, very dense, and some people would find it difficult to read cover to cover. The observations there are really valuable. But I do want to mention, Emily, I feel that his greatest contribution that he made is how to approach solving problems, because nobody does this anymore. What happens is we identify an ailment, and that can be anything, anything to do with chronic disease in this society. And then what we say is, I think I know a way to deal with this. I'm going to completely fabricate a new diet that I believe would treat this illness. And then people start eating this diet. And it's a diet that maybe no one has really embarked on before. And certainly no one has been on said diet for multiple generations, so that we can really understand the health effects, especially to later generation children. It becomes a complete experiment with the people eating said diet as guinea pigs. Weston Price didn't do that. He observed that there was a problem regarding dentition, regarding periodontal infections, small palates that led to crooked and crowded teeth and impacted wisdom teeth. And instead of saying, hey, I think I know a diet that will fix this, what he did is he traveled around the world and found people who don't have any of these problems. People who had broad faces with beautiful, straight, uncrowded teeth, that also were really resistant to dental caries, something that we have a huge issue with here in the United States. And then he observed, what do they do? And he found tremendous differences in their diet as one of the things that may be leading to all of the dental and periodontal issues that we experience here in the United States on modern diets. So his approach seems very straightforward, but it's actually a really rare thing in the health field. He found an ailment, and then he found people that don't have the ailment and studied what is it that they do to create this healthy and well-formed body that he witnessed. And that's one of his biggest contributions that is rarely mentioned. And I think that's important that people understand. He didn't just make up a diet. He went and observed the diet that was producing health. And the thing that he found in most cases, most of the people that he examined were eating either a 100% wild diet or were eating a substantial portion of wild foods. And in part, we know from observations of hunter-gatherers, not just by Weston Price, but by medical anthropologists as well, we know that chronic disease is something that is experienced by agricultural societies and not by hunter-gatherers who have access to their land. And that's a really important thing for people to realize, that even really serious ailments like cancer were virtually non-existent in long-lived hunter-gatherer communities, but yet there's something that are become increasingly more common as we go from agricultural communities to industrial civilizations. And the more our food becomes processed and a number of things. The more sedentary we become, the less exposure to nature, the more exposure to carcinogens, we just slowly trend toward greater and greater frequency of cancer in the people. And Weston Price's book is really valuable. And what's really scary about it is how few dentists, how few orthodontists, how few people in those professions have actually even heard of Weston Price. I've asked many in my life, and I have never found a single one who has heard of Weston Price. The fact that a dentist could be educated in a system that doesn't in this pivotal work is kind of scary to me.
Could you talk then about the practice in Indigenous societies of preparing both of the parents' bodies for the conception?
Yeah, it's really important to understand that their diets were largely very protective of the kinds of things that we experience today in terms of chronic disease, in terms of weak bones and narrow faces that produce these, you know, these dental issues that people experience. We're talking about diets that were much more rich in fat-soluble vitamins. We're talking about groups of people who didn't have phobias around consuming things. You know, today you look at some foods like liver and other organ meats, eggs, and particularly some fatty meat portions. These have all been kind of demonized now and are thought to actually promote chronic disease. And yet we know that the people who consume them in large amounts, again, hunter-gatherers, were largely free of chronic disease. So we have historical observations that just contradict the statements that things like organ meats and eggs and fat were actually detrimental to human health. And some of this comes down to, you know, weird ways of looking at things. Like, people think that the liver is a filter and it filters out toxins in our body. And unfortunately, this analogy is just completely wrong. The liver is a processing plant. And what it does is toxins come in and they are bound to a substance that prevents them from being absorbed in the body so they can be excreted. And they don't just build up and build up and build up like would happen in an actual filter. But because people think of it in this way, we see a lot of people who are avoiding really nutrient-dense foods that are super important for pregnant moms and for people who want to become pregnant, because they're so rich in certain fat-soluble vitamins like vitamin A, vitamin D, K2, and also things that we need to prevent deformities like folate, vitamin B9. And it's really important here because we're talking about the natural form of folate, you know, as opposed to the synthetic form, folic acid, that is, you know, that is frequently added to foods as a way to try to help people get more of this really important nutrient. But we're giving people a synthetic form and it's simply not absorbed or converted as fast as we would find in the natural form. You know, that's one message, Emily, that I would love for people to try to take away from this podcast, is your body is designed to get nutrition from food. And designed to get it in a natural form. And it's just best to eat food if you're trying to nourish yourself. And as soon as you start supplementing with something, and not that supplements are always bad, there are conditions that respond well to supplementation, but generally speaking, when we're taking supplements, we're admitting that our diet is missing certain nutritional features. It's an admission that we need to change how we're eating, because supplementation has simply never been needed to produce healthy babies. It can be done through our diet. I realized that you had mentioned prenatal injury and I hadn't referred to that. And I think this was a really brilliant thing that Weston Price caught on to long before a widespread understanding of epigenetics came into being. Of course, we know that our genes provide a code that our DNA houses, and this is how we essentially create the proteins that we need to build our bodies and to regulate how our metabolism functions. But the issue is that those genes are not necessarily expressed correctly. In other words, they cannot be turned on to make proteins that we need, or they can be turned on for too long or turned off too quickly. And in large part, it's our nutrition that tells our genes when to turn on to build the various proteins that our body needs. And this expression of our DNA is the field of epigenetics. And we know that when our grandparents and our parents have had nutrient poor diets, when they have experienced lifelong chronic stress and exposures to pollution and things of that nature, that children can end up with, you know, sometimes serious issues, even though they may have eaten a decent diet in their lifetime, because we're seeing a fouled up expression of DNA, I'll call it. And this was what he was referring to with this prenatal injury, that there were things that were happening long before birth, potentially with the parents, such that it was interfering with them producing healthy and well-formed children. So, I mean, nutrient-dense diets, happiness, finding purpose in the world, being exposed to the elements in a conscientious fashion, all of these things are the kinds of things that promote proper epigenetic expression. And those are the kinds of things that we want to surround ourselves with as much as possible to make sure that we're able to have good pregnancies and healthy babies.
So you mentioned folate before, and there's something that I've been curious about for a while, and I wonder if you have the answer for me. So it's quite widely understood now how vital it is to increase folate during pregnancy, especially in that first trimester. And folate is abundant in leafy greens, which are typically in the natural world plentiful in springtime. So I imagine that our nomadic ancestors would have eaten this in abundance in springtime while it was available, and that would have stored up enough folate in their bodies to see them through the summer and autumn, and then come winter, their bodies were using the last of the diminishing folate supply before spring rolled around again. So my question is, though, how would this have worked for nomadic women who would conceive a child at the beginning of winter when their folate supply was at its lowest?
She would be able to still access folate through the animal foods in her diet. And it would be important for her to be prioritized in getting the organ meats from, for example, from the animals that were taken, because folate is something that is richly endowed in the organ meats, and particularly the liver of the animals. And so while there are many wonderful plant sources, greens, legumes, and nuts that have folate, obviously in temperate and northern cultures, these plant sources might be absent or with very limited availability during that time, like you mentioned, but the animal foods would continue to supply her. And, you know, it's something that we do here in this house, in this community. Pregnant women and developing children get the priority when it comes to nutrition. And so should there ever be, you know, the last piece of, you know, whatever food that's on the table, that goes to those two people. You know, the pregnant woman is someone who has a developing child within her, and the young children that are around the table have greater nutritional needs than the mature adults do. And so we just make sure that anybody who is either with child or is a child gets the priority on some of these really important foods that are super nutrient dense, whether those be organ meats or eggs from pastured chickens and things of that nature, those things that we can still access during the winter.
Okay, so then with regards to what you've just mentioned, how does a diet such as vegetarianism affect the bodies of the mother and the developing fetus?
Yeah, this is a really important topic, I feel, Emily, but it also is one that can be really contentious because diet, like many other aspects of modern living, have become religions. And when I refer to it as a religion, I'm talking to people who really only study the pros of what they do, but they do not study the cons. And when you only study the benefits, or at least the perceived benefits of a particular action you're taking, it's really easy to sort of bolster your confidence that this is the only thing you should be doing. You know, when you surround yourself with friends who all eat in the same way, there's never any critical, yeah, but hey guys, what about these? And there are some really important things that we know about vegetarian diets in children. Especially when we talk about vegan diets, where we're really, you know, there's an attempt to remove all animal foods. We know that such diets are really poor in certain fat-soluble vitamins. For example, vitamin D, we don't have D3, you know, the cholecalciferol form. That's not found in plants and fungi. It's a form that's less bioavailable and less active in the body, vitamin D2. Also, vitamin A, there are active forms of this, like retinol, and retinoic acid. Those are the forms that our body uses, and they're found in animal foods. And what's found in plant foods are carotenoids. And while these can be converted into the active forms of vitamin A, that conversion process is really inefficient, and we tend to get on order of maybe 10 to 20% of the carotenoids that we eat actually transition over or transform to the active forms of vitamin A. And you know, there are studies which are demonstrating that this is a real problem. There was a beautiful study in 2000 that was looking at vitamin B12 levels, and it showed that this actually affects fluid intelligence. And other things, spatial ability and short-term memory, were all impacted in vegan children. Omnivorous children, so they were eating plants and animals, even though they weren't even eating high-quality animal foods, they still scored higher on, you know, different exams that focused on cognitive traits. And that's really a really important thing, I think, to bring out, that a vegan diet is impacting cognition in the child. There was another study from the country of Kenya that looked at what happened when vegetarian children were supplemented with animal foods. And this particular study showed that when animal foods were brought into the diet, that cognitive function increased. But we had other increases as well. Things like interaction skills, leadership, and of course, muscle mass also increased. And these factors are really important to consider because, I mean, this is your child. It's a developing human. We know that humans historically were omnivores, and in fact, even the breast milk that we give to our children is an animal food. You know, we have vegans who will often think of that as, well, that doesn't count. It's coming from me. But they actually are supporting animal nutrition early in life. You know, I often say, hey, if we were to pump human breast milk and then, say, feed that to the family dog, no one would claim you were giving them a plant food. That's clearly an animal food. And so even hardcore vegans are, through their actions when they breastfeed, are demonstrating that animal foods are really important for developing humans. And what I don't want to do is to set my children up in a way that they have an obstacle. Because unfortunately, like it or not, we live in a very competitive world, and I want them to have the highest cognitive function they're capable of having to make sure that they're able to just thrive in this world.
Can you speak to any of the mainstream guidelines surrounding foods during pregnancy, such as avoiding soft cheeses because of listeria and certain types of fish because of mercury?
Yeah, this is almost all based on really terrible science. And I can tell you that, for example, my partner and I, and that includes my ex-partner with the birth of my daughter, we in fact purchase almost exclusively raw cheeses, and that includes occasional soft cheeses. We pay next to no attention to those kinds of things. You know, there's a huge fear around unpasteurized dairy, and literally every piece of dairy that we purchase, whether this be butter, cheese, fermented kinds like yogurt and kefir, or just milk for that matter, are always raw because we don't want the nutrition in these damaged by heat and by the homogenization process that ends up creating, in some cases, a more allergenic food. Avoiding fish in pregnancy is also really bad science. And I wrote a blog on this not that long ago that kind of demonstrates that, you know, the mercury that is found in fish is offset in many cases by the selenium that is found in fish. So if you take, for example, tuna, one of the species that's always brought up in this discussion of mercury, mercury is something that in order to damage the body, it has to overcome the selenium stores in the environment, in the human body. And so selenium is highly protective of mercury, and tuna contains far more selenium than it does mercury. The warnings based on fish consumption and mercury come from one of three studies that were done examining human health and fish consumption. Two of the studies found that there was no impact, and one of the studies found that there were some really important health impacts to consuming fish with mercury, and that's the one our country decided to use. However, the population that was studied in that particular study were also consuming pilot whale. And this is a mammalian species that long-lived, taking in a lot of mercury into their system, but were very low in selenium, the mineral that is protective of mercury. And so the point that I'm trying to make is this was just absolutely terrible science. And, you know, there's other ways of protecting yourself from things like mercury that are found in fish if you're concerned. And that's the consumption of things like edible clays, which can bind to heavy metals and prevent their absorption, or chlorella and spirulina. Chlorella is one that we use in our house here. When we have fish meals, we also consume chlorella with them. And the cell wall components of chlorella are shown to bind to mercury and other heavy metals. And rather than being absorbed into our bodies, they are excreted. And there's a study from Japan showing that not only is it heavy metals that are excreted from the body, but women who were consuming chlorella during pregnancy also had lower levels of things like dioxins in their body because some of these other environmental pollutants are also mopped up by chlorella. So there are ways to protect yourself. What you don't want to do is avoid these fatty fishes that are high in DHA, one form of omega-3 fatty acid that is really important for brain formation and also eye health in your developing child. You want to find ways to consume the foods and protect yourself. So eating things that are rich in selenium, like Brazil nuts and oysters, is a much better way to go about this whole issue rather than just avoiding fish altogether, because then you miss out on all of the nutrition found in fish.
So you've talked already about how internal organs such as liver are incredibly rich in nutrients, yet liver is something pregnant women are told to avoid because it's high in vitamin A. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, that's just, again, extremely poor science. Yeah. No one is claiming that you're supposed to eat vitamin A, consume liver, which is rich in vitamin A, on a daily basis. That's not what we're talking about. But making sure that that is served, you know, maybe once a week or once every other week for pregnant women, that's a really important thing. And you definitely find that the food forms, when you're taking these vitamins in through your diet, almost without exception, there are simply not the issues that arise during supplementation. That's when you can actually take in too much of a particular thing, because not only are you taking these things in a concentrated form, but you're often not taking them with the cofactors that you need to make sure that they are used properly and stored properly in your diet. And when we eat them in our food, we're getting a whole suite of vitamins and minerals, which include the cofactors of the things that we might be going after. Really, vitamin A is one of those things that have been maligned in the literature, and it's simply really important. I mean, we need this to make sure that we have healthy and well-formed children. And it's really important for the functioning of our immune system and a number of other things that we could go into. Liver and other organ meats are something that are, you know, on the table with relative high frequency, especially during pregnancy and also during breastfeeding.
I've heard many people say that rice cereal is an excellent first food for babies because the manufacturers have added in lots of nutrients to it. This is also the case for many other industrially manufactured foods, not just those targeted for infants. It's almost as if because the low nutrient foods have had synthetic nutrients added to them, they are believed to be much better for you than the naturally nutrient-rich foods. This is what you've already talked about earlier on. And along the same lines, pregnant women are encouraged to take supplements and prenatal vitamins rather than guided towards a nutrient-dense diet that would deem these supplements unnecessary. So can you offer any insight into supplements and synthetic nutrients during pregnancy for babies and also just for the average person?
Yeah, I'll answer that question, Emily, in this way. Every generation of people have this kind of hubris, if you will, that they now know everything. And in other words, all of the past mistakes that have been generated in nutritional studies and so on, those have all been corrected now, and now we know everything. And yet, if you were to look at the nutritional science that's coming out in the literature, we're just learning more and more, and also how deeply complex this whole issue is. And we're overturning things that have long been believed by multiple generations of people, like, you know, the lipid hypothesis was long believed, you know, that fats were very bad for us, and that has actually been overturned in recent years. And we have seen where, you know, governmental agencies have recommended certain things only to find out that that was particularly harmful to people and have had to modify their recommendations. I just suggest that people circumvent that whole thing and get back as close to our ancestral diets as you possibly can. That way you don't have to worry about scientific literature guiding nutrition and scientific literature that was often done with a priori and assumptions about specific foods and their health. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of research that's done that begins with the assumption that red meat is bad for us and causes cancer and heart disease. And yet we know that there were nomadic hunter-gatherer people who relied extensively on animals that were rich in red meats, whether we're talking about the plains natives and the buffalo that they consumed, as just one example. And these people were free of such ailments. That is something that we really only see in modern agriculturalists and industrialists. And so the way for you to not get caught up in any potential bias in science and be given recommendations assumptions that are only going to be overturned 20 years from now is to go back to the root of what humans have always eaten, go back to our ancestral methods of nourishing, you know, nourishing pregnant women and developing children. And there are plenty of good sources on this kind of information. I just recommend that we just try to detach as much as we can where possible from industry and just remember that food is the medicine that we're supposed to be eating, not pills.
Could you share with us a major misconception about the value of wild foods, especially in relation to pregnancy and childhood?
Well, I think the misconceptions around wild foods just run really deep because of a philosophical viewpoint that humans have, particularly modern humans. We are kind of told that wild plants, for example, are very dangerous and that they can poison us and kill us, and that the only safe plants to consume are those that are produced by agriculture, those that are found in our supermarkets. We have what some refer to as this intrinsic taboo, and that is that humans who live, you know, within the confines of industry have to be told to fear the wild. And without that, we lose a measure of control over them. And we see this, you know, the phobia of wild things perhaps is never as deep as it is with wild fungi, that wild mushrooms are also going to poison and kill us. And this is where our deepest nutrition is found, is in the wild. And so I'm sort of stepping back here, and rather than providing exact examples or specific examples, I'm trying to get people to understand that civilization itself has created in us a fear of the wild. And while we need caution, caution is what keeps us alive, phobias are just detrimental to our health in general. And we need to work through these so that we can get back to, for those people that have access to open space where wild plants and animals grow, where we can get back to something that more closely mimics our ancestral diets.
And what could be changed at a large scale to help prevent prenatal injury?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that we would need to do in order to prevent that on a large scale. That genetic expression or epigenetics that we spoke about is something that we need to understand, that we are stewards of our genome. We often think about humans as stewarding the landscape and trying to be good caregivers to the landscape, but we forget that we are also stewarding our DNA for the time that it's housed inside of our body. And we steward this through, again, good nutrition and avoiding stress and finding a valuable purpose in life that gives us contentment. And there are a number of other ways that we do this. But when we actually realize that we're passing on a kind of genetic expression to the next generation that could harm them in a way that they could never reach their full potential, health-wise, physically, emotionally, spiritually, when we realize that the DNA inside of our body is something that we also have to protect, that would make a really huge difference, because it would mean that we need to really focus on our diet. We need to stay away from chemical agriculture and highly processed foods and all of the sweets and snacks and things that we might find at a convenience store. These things harm ultimately our DNA expression and cause our children and grandchildren to have to overcome these things. I do wish that people would think about stewarding their DNA. Again, very similar to how we think of stewarding the land, because we know we pass that on to the next generation.
I like that, yeah. Okay, so full disclosure here, I have not yet read your book, A New Path, but that's only because we are moving back to New Zealand in a couple of months, so I'm waiting to buy it once we're back there. So could you tell us some more about it?
Yeah, thanks for asking. A New Path was really what I tried to do is give people all of the arguments for why a more nature-connected lifestyle and one that takes into account our ancestral norms is in fact a healthy lifestyle for both humans and the landscapes that we rely on. I make the case that humans do have biological norms. In other words, we know that there is a certain diet that this wild species or that wild species eats, or there's a certain landscape that they live in and a certain form of social structure that they're used to interacting with. And humans have all of these things too. And industrial societies really try to transcend our biology. They're trying to essentially have humans express things that are not within our biology, that are far from our ancestral norms. And when we do this, we always run into problems. And I mean always. And this book lays out those arguments using that lens that I told folks about in the early part of this interview, using a combination of observations of historical hunter-gatherers and modern scientific studies. And we find a large area of corroboration there. And so the book uses both of those to help demonstrate that when humans follow their biological norms as best we can in this modern world, that we can actually experience greater health than by ignoring them.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to be buying that book. Where would you like people to buy it?
Well, there's a number of places to buy it, but of course, if they were to purchase it through my website, which is just arthurhaynes.com, it makes it much easier because we get to keep, you know, more of the profits. And here at the community, Wilder Waters community where I live, all of those profits are being used to purchase land. We are really big into land conservation because humans need wild landscapes in order to roam through, to experience, to forage, to hunt, to gather medicine, and just to live with them. And that's what we're trying to do. We're not talking about a type of conservation that where wild organisms are prevented from interacting with humans, or vice versa, where humans are prevented from interacting with the wild organisms. But we want one where reciprocal interactions, where both parties are benefited in the long run, can occur. So we're talking about a very specific kind of conservation. And in order to do that, when where we live, there is so much private land holdings that in order to have kind of a guaranteed access to our wild landscapes, we need to purchase that land and set that up in a format that later generations will have access to that. And so that's where those proceeds go to.
So I will put links in the show notes to your website, the website and Instagram page for Wilder Waters Community, your YouTube channel and your TEDx talk. Is there anywhere else you would like people to go or get in contact with you?
Oh, no, that's really wonderful. Of course, I am on Facebook and I'm easy to find. But yeah, I really appreciate you being willing to provide those links for people, Emily.
Yeah, not a problem. Arthur, it has been such a pleasure speaking with you today. My biggest challenge in preparing for this interview was now narrowing down all the questions I have for you. I really appreciate you taking the time to share your knowledge with us. Do you have any final words to add?
No, well, other than just thanking you for inviting me on your show, Emily, and, you know, if the interest arises, maybe we could do another one in the future on some other topic. But I really appreciate you thinking of me and being part of the show.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.